Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm, specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export control compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diana Pilipenko.
Thank you so much for having me.
And obviously, all eyes are glued on the Manafort trial, where his deputy, Rick Gates, has turned state's evidence against him. And of course, Manafort's defense are trying to blame everything on Gates. I don't think that's working, is it? Do you?
I don't think so. Gates has made some very compelling allegations and testimonies. And what's more, the prosecution has also presented plenty of documented evidence, be they emails or certain corporate records that bolster their arguments and their allegations. So, for instance, when they discuss bank fraud or misrepresenting income or classifying income as loans in order to not have to pay taxes or hiding foreign bank accounts, they've also presented documents that sort of back up those statements.
But the broader picture surely is how much money Manafort made out of his work to get Yanukovych elected in Ukraine. The estimates that have been published in conjunction with this trial say he was paid $60 million. I spoke recently with Anders Asland, who worked in Ukraine at the time and knew Manafort when he was working for Yanukovych. He said that Manafort was actually paid $9 million a year for 10 years, so that's $90 million. Do you have any idea of exactly how much he was paid?
The figure that I've seen is $60 million as well, but I think, and perhaps it was more, but I think what's really important is only a fraction was officially reported. So much of the income that he's derived from his consulting work in Ukraine has been, funneled through secret accounts in Cyprus, and, which indicates that perhaps some of it was ill-gotten or illicit, or simply that was the means of circumventing certain regulations and taxes. So I think the contrast between what was officially reported and what he made in actuality is very significant.
But in effect, wasn't Manafort really being paid by Putin? I mean, Manafort's right-hand man, Konstantin Kalimnik, apparently is a GRU officer, and it's inconceivable that Manafort would have been controlling Russian media for Yanukovych, which is what he did, without the Kremlin being involved and sanctioning it.
I think the trial and other evidence that has come to the fore has, in some ways, is consistent with pro-Russian interests and who was actually paying Manafort for his work there. We know that, for instance, he was initially introduced to the Ukrainians, to Rinat Akhmetov, the Russian oligarch who was backing the Party of Regions in Ukraine. He was introduced to them by Oleg Deripaska, a Russian oligarch and somebody who's deemed fairly close to the Kremlin. And so there is a certain confluence or alliance that's forged. And of course, the Party of Regions is very much had a pro-Kremlin platform. In fact, when Yanukovych fled, he fled to Russia. So I think that is certainly out there, and this is why these relationships, even though they may be, in some cases peripheral, are still central to the questions regarding collusion and what may have transpired during the 2016 presidential campaign here in the United States.
And again, excuse me. And again, I'm speaking with Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm, specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export control compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. And Deanna, you just used the word oligarch. The judge in the Manafort trial has forbidden the prosecution for using that word. Well, you're from Ukraine. Ukraine has been basically run by oligarchs, and that's been their struggle, has it not, to get out of the away from the Russian Putin model of kleptocracy into a more democratic model with the rule of law?
Absolutely. Ukraine has been plagued by corruption since independence, and it's been very difficult to shake it. And Manafort, too, when he was brought on board, he was paid by the oligarchs backing the interests of the party. And so this model whereby the interests of the government and the interests of business are completely sort of blurred and converge is one that has, has engendered some of these issues of corruption. And the term oligarch, I think, because of the sort of the way the post-Soviet assets and were privatized, it's gained sort of a bad connotation. And I think that's why Judge Ellis has asked that the term not be used, because I think right now it's not just business tycoons, but ones that have, you know, allegedly engaged in corruption and gaining their wealth. And so that's a very sort of packed and fraught term. And especially in the context that we use it, often oligarchs are deemed close to the state, of be it the state of Ukraine or the state of Russia.
So Oleg Deripaska, I think he loaned about $30 million. Actually, he gave Manafort $30 million to invest through offshore Caribbean tax avoidance vehicles. And I think something like at least $10 million of that money disappeared. And we know from this trial that Manafort was absolutely frantically trying to inflate his worth and get bank loans, and forged a bunch of documents to get bank loans, because he was trying to pay off Deripaska. And then the minute that Manafort took the job, even though he was broke, he took the job for no money to be Trump's campaign manager, suddenly it appears that all was forgiven with Deripaska. And then he offered Deripaska private briefings, and they changed the platform of the Republican Party to be much more Russia-friendly. Then the minute that Manafort was no longer, when he was fired by Jared Kushner, suddenly Deripaska comes back into the picture and sues him. So I guess my first question would be, you wouldn't want to owe Deripaska money, right? He was kept out of the United States because it's alleged that he killed about 42 people in the so-called aluminum wars when he took over the aluminum monopoly in Russia.
Deripaska has a very, as far as Russian oligarchs go, he has a very fearsome reputation, and I would say yes, you do not want to owe him $19 million, which I believe is what has been reported that Manafort owed him after he failed to make investments on his behalf. And yes, there were sort of two periods to Manafort. Initially, he was making a lot of money in Ukraine, millions of dollars. But then after the Yanukovych party lost power and Yanukovych fled, the sources of income for Manafort dried up. And, you know, on top of that, he was in debt to Deripaska and perhaps others. And yes, it seems an alternative means of sort of financing that debt proved to be access that he offered. And of course, there have been plenty of reporting specifically on his offers of private briefings to Deripaska. And Deripaska is seen to be fairly close to the Kremlin. He was recently sanctioned, he as well as his companies. And so this sort of a quid pro quo, if you will, is very troubling and has been very closely scrutinized. And perhaps there will be more information that will come to the fore as to the specific arrangement that was floated.
Well, but if you use the sort of gangster analogy, and I think that's fair because Russia today is a gangster state with a with the godfather of the godfathers in charge. He regulates the oligarchs. They're allowed to loot the country, but then they have to do what he tells them to do. Otherwise, like Khodorkovsky, they'll lose their billions and be lucky to flee into exile. So that's the system. So isn't it logical that there is a Kremlin connection throughout this? That, in other words, you get Manafort hooked on money, you know he's greedy, you loan him money, he's terrified, and then he ends up being the campaign manager of the person who you most want to influence in the world, the possible president of the United States. And we won't go into the details about how much speculation there is about exactly how much influence Putin has over Trump, but it was pretty evident from the press conference after the Helsinki meeting that they'd conducted in secret with no record. A lot of suspicions about that have arisen. So what do you think about that as a logical scenario, that the hand of the Kremlin seems to be behind this 100%, and that's probably why Mueller is interested in Manafort and trying to squeeze him?
Yes, Manafort is an apt operative. He's had these longstanding connections to Eastern Europe, which, you know, could have been very much exploited during the campaign. And I think it's effective to pair Manafort and sort of his connections and potential ways in which he was compromised with Russia's overall effort to interfere in the election. It wasn't just Manafort. It wasn't just the June 9th meeting, which Manafort attended. If you recall, the Russian government attorney who came allegedly offering dirt on their political opponent. But it was also the hacking of the DNC servers. It was also the broad sprawling social media campaign that the Internet Research Agency has undertaken. So it was a multi-pronged approach, if you will. And so, and behind some of these efforts, including somebody like Maria Butina, somebody who was also indicted recently as an agent of the Russian government, behind all of these efforts, there's money. You know, sometimes it's connected to specific oligarchs that maybe are vying for a spot in Putin's inner circle, and so it's a very complex system. But what's evident is this was a very multifaceted sort of operation, and I think the special counsel investigation is sort of unearthing all the different elements of it.
And in the broader sense, Deanna, at least it's my belief that what's going on here is that basically you're dealing with Putin, who's kind of a gangster. And we've never had this situation in geopolitics, the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia, and nuclear weapons. So it's a very different situation altogether. But obviously, nuclear weapons are irrelevant in a sense because nobody wants to use them. So when Putin was sanctioned for annexing Crimea and starting a war with Ukraine, what choices did he have? Not much. But the one choice that I think he chose is to use this form of hybrid warfare that he has perfected. He's perfected it in earlier attacks on the Baltic states, for example. And a part of hybrid warfare is this way to screw with the Americans beneath the threshold of what they call kinetic warfare. So this is the way I see it. As long as we're sanctioning him, and by the way, today the State Department just added sanctions against Russia because of the use of Novichok nerve agent in the UK. So as long as we're sanctioning Putin, he's going to screw with us. Isn't that logical?
Well, in one sense, that would be counterproductive. The more sanctions we impose, the sort of more troubles he caused. So I don't know that I would say that, but we have to. And you're right. He's sort of engaged in recent years. He's engaged in this hybrid, almost asymmetric warfare. And through exploitations of divisions that exist in the West, that exist here in the United States, and they've been pretty effective tools, I would say, and they're are continuing to use them. I think we've had recent reporting that issues with social media continue to this day and are threatening the November elections. There's various means of using cyber warfare to also undermine infrastructure and other important sort of functions. So it's not clear what the best sort of, at least to me, I'm not a statesman or in terms of what the best approach is to deal with Putin. But I think when the West hasn't reacted very strongly to his annexation of Crimea and the meddling that he's done in Ukraine, I think that emboldened him, to be sure. And kind of a useful book, perhaps I would recommend to your listeners, is called The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder, a Yale professor, and he kind of goes back and unpacks some of the tactics Putin has used in the West and here in the United States after the Crimea annexation. And certainly asymmetric warfare is something that he's very reliant on.
Well, you mentioned the November elections. To my mind, it's not inconceivable that Vladimir Putin will sabotage the elections. It's a part of the same playbook that he's used in 2016, and he didn't necessarily think Trump was going to win. Like most people, he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, but he had his bases covered because had Hillary Clinton won, Donald Trump would be going around this country holding rallies saying, lock her up, lock her up, and that would continue to divide America, and that is what Putin's tactic is. And we, of course, help him a lot because we are divided and we are balkanized in terms of our thinking and our politics, etc. So my sense is that he will screw with the 2018 elections and that the Democratic blue wave may be taken away through cyber meddling. And then there'll be enormous repercussions and tremendous dislocation and enormous anger. And, of course, Trump is not going to – he's going to lose the House probably. And if suddenly the Republicans miraculously maintain control of the House, there'd be all hell to pay. So I know it sounds a little far-fetched to a lot of our listeners, but I don't think it's that far-fetched. I think it's perhaps even almost inevitable.
Yes, there's great concern that this interference will continue on through the November elections and perhaps in 2020 as well. And our hope is that the experience of the past elections will inspire legislators to really safeguard our elections. And there have already been bills and legislation introduced on election security, and this is a matter of great importance. And hopefully this experience, the investigation, will help galvanize not only the public but also our elected officials to take this threat more seriously.
Well, just in closing, today we had the charges of insider trading against Congressman Chris Collins, a Republican of New York, who was the first congressman to endorse Donald Trump. We also learned from Forbes magazine that the Secretary of Treasury, Wilbur Ross, stole $230 million from a business partner and had to quietly settle that before he became Commerce Secretary. So how much are we becoming the kind of kleptocracy under Donald Trump that Putin has perfected in Russia?
It is becoming increasingly a concern. This administration has seen unprecedented issues of corruption. Everyone many in Trump's orbit are confronting it. Just the other day, Wall Street Journal, for instance, reported that Michael Cohen, too, may be facing charges of bank fraud, tax evasion in New York. And this is, of course, the same Michael Cohen who allegedly offered access to Trump to different companies, even one connected to Russia and a Russian oligarch. So this issue of self-dealing, corruption, it's certainly a theme of this administration. And unfortunately, there are echoes of political systems in places like Eastern Europe. And it's something that we should be very much aware of and something we should recognize and not normalize. Corruption, you know, institutions are not infallible, and corruption can become normalized. It seems each new low is sort of absorbed and we move on. And I think we shouldn't. It's an important issue that I think Democrats are doing a good job of highlighting in the coming elections, and certainly looking at some of these other systems like Ukraine should prove a warning to how things can erode and democratic institutions can erode and not recover easily.
Well, Diana Pilipenko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export controls compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with an expert on Turkey about how Vice President Pence's ties to the evangelical community has made the release of an American fundamentalist pastor a top priority.